I'm speaking with composer Ching-Chu Hu, who is on the faculty of Denison University in Granville, Ohio, here in Central Ohio. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your work, The Swash of Water in Red, will be aired on Classical 101's American music program, The American Sound, on June 13th and 16th as the Columbus Arts Festival unfolds. What was your inspiration for this work?
Well, for me, I've always enjoyed writing for stringed instruments. And there was an opportunity to write a string quartet for a recording in Moscow, as well as for a quartet here in Columbus, the Sonus Artis Quartet. And for me, when I start writing, I like to sort of mix up images and the use of color or things like the variety of ways water sort of plays in our life. I like to play with that. So then these movements are sort of juxtaposing various ideas of color and of water.
And what ideas of color and water, more specifically, are you playing with here?
I think water has always been such a powerful image for me, and whether it's sort of the gentle mist of rain or sort of the sound of an ocean or, you know, how still and how cold ice is, you know, I think it's always very nice to sort of be able to sort of play with that because everyone can understand that. And then the image of red I thought was very nice because it can mean passion, it can mean love, but it could also be anguish, it could also be anger. So it sort of has lots of other meanings, so I can sort of pair the two up in a way that sort of maybe can justify the mood or the movement or moving through the movements to sort of a compilation of sounds and images.
So ideas of water and color. For this particular piece, were there any other specific forms of inspiration?
Well, I think part of the inspiration is sort of always trying to just see what I could add to the repertoire. You know, as a composer, if I sit down and think about the fact that I'm writing a string quartet, it can be kind of overwhelming. I mean, when you think about the canon of string quartets, it becomes hard to sort of feel like, okay, what could I add to that? That would be a little bit different. And throughout sort of schooling and throughout sort of the writing process, I think all composers start realizing, okay, the only way we can add to the canon is to write in our own voice. We can't really mimic somebody else, but we need to just bring to the table what we have inside of us. So for me, that's sort of a combination of growing up in a dual culture household, being Chinese and speaking Chinese and having that as part of my world, but yet living in the United States and growing up in a Western society and having sort of that tension or that melding of influences. My father would always, every weekend morning, would be blasting the music for us to wake up. So our house would be constantly filled with classical music as well as Chinese Peking opera or folk music or Peter, Paul, and Mary or whatever. It's like a big mixture of sound. And for me, crossing those boundaries was just sort of my dad's way of mixing music during the weekend. I didn't classify one as one type of music to listen to and one as another. It was just part and parcel of the same thing. So I think with this quartet, it was sort of the idea of, okay, with my identity, how do I bring sort of this Asian American-ness perspective into what I want to write? And I think partly because of the history, the transition and the trajectory of string quartets, for me, I thought, okay, well, I don't want to write it in a very sort of traditional four-movement form, but rather I thought, okay, let me think of this as almost a suite of pieces for these four instruments and write sort of five different moods.
As I mentioned earlier, the first two movements or moods of your work, The Swash of Water in Red, will be aired on The American Sound on Classical 101, June 13th and 16th. Almost by way of giving us a sort of listening guide for those movements, could you talk about the inspiration for each of those movements and also what's going on in them?
The first movement is I See Silent Morn. One thing that your listeners might hear in these various movements is sort of hearkening to some Eastern sounds, some Chinese sounds. And I did that through sort of the inflection of some of the instruments, but also trying to let the instruments sort of mimic other Chinese instruments. Obviously, a easy relationship to sort of think about is how the violin can be like the Chinese fiddle or the two-string fiddle, which is called the erhu. So I sort of try to craft the lines to sort of think of that a little bit. But also there's other instruments that are in play as well in a variety of movements. One is the pipa, which is a Chinese lute. So you'll hear the quartet plucking and strumming their instruments and using picks to sort of give a brighter sound, as well as the sheng, which is like a Chinese sort of mouth organ with all these different bamboo pipes. And it's a very nasal sound. You can almost think of it as maybe a chorus of oboes, if you will, playing. And so I wanted to get that edge, that nasalness out there as well. So there's that kind of inflection. So for the first movement, it's sort of creating this landscape, this sort of almost frozen tundra, if you will, and sort of a lone character out there and sort of wailing, this idea of being able to scream or cry. No one else will hear, but you can be out there and be as loud as you want and fill the whole space.
And what are your ideas behind the second movement, River Flight?
River Flight, then part of what I like to do is sort of try to create contrasting moments. So the second one then, the second movement, it's called River Flight, and it settles a little bit more into sort of a diatonic mode, and it's very flowing. The lines are very easy to listen to and to understand. The melody sort of just rushes by, and all four instruments sort of work together to create this sort of riverbed, I guess, of sound and melodies. So they sort of just rush on by, and sort of a very gentle, soothing texture that contrasts the first one.
Skipping ahead to the fourth movement, I understand that this movement was a bit of an interesting case as you were composing the piece.
What's interesting is I actually had written a complete other movement for this work, and I wasn't satisfied with it. And the deadline was looming, but I knew that if I just submitted it with the previous movement, I would never be satisfied. So I think it was even 10 days before the deadline. I thought, okay, I'm going to try again. And I think most of the material then for this movement sort of came out in sort of one session.
In a way, you've already answered this question in the affirmative, but are you pretty easily able to force yourself to compose, or do you typically require more of a muse-like inspiration?
Oh, that's a good question. I think work always expands to fill the time that you have. So then if I were given a project and said, hey, can you do this in 2 weeks? I would sort of take a deep breath and be like, okay, let's see what we would do in 2 weeks, and you sort of get it done. But if you say like, oh, you know what, you have 3 months, then it will take me all of 3 months to complete it. So I think in terms of that, deadlines work well for me, even though it sometimes upsets sort of the family balance of daily life and all that stuff. But I think I've learned that usually the busier I am, the more productive I am as well. But I think as a composer, you have to listen to that voice. And if it even means that you now only have a few days to complete it, you aren't doing your work justice if you sort of ignore that voice.
The American composer Aaron Copland had this tremendously fruitful and productive career, writing and writing and writing. And all of a sudden, he reached a point, and he was a fairly old man at this point, where he said, the well's run dry.
Oh.
Has the well ever sort of run dry? Has there ever been a roadblock for you in your creative process, if you will, that has just been insurmountable?
Oh, wow. I hope not. I hope this is not a jinx. No, so far not. I think there may have been sort of aesthetic issues or compositional issues or like knots that I need to sort of unravel and sort of figure out like, okay, if I've done this, what does that mean now? Like, what is the that after this? But I think in terms of sort of running out of ideas, no, I think it's been great. This past year, I was on sabbatical for the calendar year of 2014. So I was fortunate enough to do some residencies, like at the McDowell Colony and Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. And I'll be doing a few more coming up. But what's so nice about those residencies is it allows you to be so selfish with your time and just have that time to sort of be introspective and just come up with ideas. One of the best lessons I learned from one of my former teachers and mentors, William Bolcom, he talked about how he would have a little basket beside his piano and he would write these tunes, and he would just, it's almost like a daily warm-up. We will take a tune and he'll just put it in the basket. So then he'll have a basket of tunes that he may or may not ever use, but then whenever he might need it, he can go and be like, oh yes, I came up with this before or something, and then boom, pull it in. And so what I realized coming from out of those residencies is that I have notebooks full of ideas that I'll just wait to use at some point. So I'm hoping as a composer that 20 years from now, I'll still be going back to the well that I got from my sabbatical this last year, and coming up with ideas of new projects and new connections and new ways of demonstrating my voice.
So it's never a waste of time.
I don't think so. Yeah. I think it's always productive. And I paused for a second because I thought of the fact that, like, sometimes to compose, you almost have to, or I almost have to, almost take a nap. But I'm not actually taking a nap. I'll lie down and start at a point of, let's say, this not frustration, but like, okay, I have this knot. I don't know how to untie it. So I'm going to just close my eyes and almost drift off to sleep. But during that time, a solution sort of happens. And then I could go to the piano or wherever. I'm like, aha, now I know what to do.
You mentioned earlier in our interview that your dual culture background as a Chinese American is a strong influence in your work. Are there other similar kind of overriding influences that you find to be particularly fruitful for you?
Well, I think for me, this idea of lyricism is very important to me. It's something where I think during my schooling, I may have sort of tried to find sort of other ways of composing and other techniques. But then through this process of learning more about myself, I just realized I'm still drawn to this idea of something lyrical, some kind of melody or something that sort of pulls me along. And so that's something that definitely is in my music, and it's something that if I tried not to do it, it just wouldn't be me. So I think that's something that's there, and it's not really a sort of a cultural thing, I don't think, but just sort of an idea.
When you look back at music of the 18th century, there's clearly a style going on there. When you look at music of the 19th century, there's very much a style going on there. Music of the High Baroque, very much a style and so forth. The 20th century, you can tell a 20th century piece of music, but the style is all over the map.
Exactly.
You know, the styles are all over the map. Where are we?
I have a feeling you're going to lead up to this. I don't know. I feel like there's so much out there now, but I feel like there's also definitely more of a fusion. You know, there's also sort of more interdisciplinary influences in music. I think music for the screen is really important. And when I say screen, I don't even mean just movies, but like movies, TV, screen platforms of video games and stuff. All of that has taken off so that I see at least students who are interested in sort of doing it all. They want to write for a solo instrument, but they also want to write for a game. And so I think crossing these boundaries, you have composers who are also being influenced as sort of DJs or by rock and funk and pop and hip hop, and you bring all that stuff into the concert hall, if you will. Or in fact, you know, so many people are also trying to find other venues. So I feel like the idea of music, not only aesthetically, is sort of more diverse, but also the venues where music can happen seems to be sort of breaking down some of those walls as well. So it could be in a coffee house or outside in a park or on a porch, you know, and or on a street, and not just in a concert hall where you have to sit very properly and listen. You know, so it's, you know, there seems to be so much going on, and hopefully there's, you know, audiences for all the different kinds of styles.
So for you, moving ahead or looking ahead, talk about some future projects.
Okay. It's funny. I just had a premiere of a violin concerto that I wrote, and that was a lot of fun. So we're trying to see where else we can go with that. But I'm in the middle of a project of scoring a live orchestra soundtrack to Charlie Chaplin's The Gold Rush, which will be done in the fall down in West Texas A&M. And so that's been a lot of fun because that's a very, very different project. And it's something where you have to be so careful with scoring for the orchestra because they will be playing the whole time. So you got to make sure that people aren't going to go crazy playing, you know, solidly for almost 90 minutes. But it's also fun to match it up with visuals, and it'll be nice to have sort of the laughter as feedback and trying to come up with music that will fit the images but then still have my voice in it. Although, you know, I won't be using sort of any affectations to sort of hearken to an Asian sound for Charlie Chaplin, but it's still something that'll be, I'm sure people will hear and they'll think, oh yeah, that's you, you know, or hopefully they will.
That is becoming all the rage right now, bringing silent films back to life, as it were, with live performances of the scores, of fresh new scores as well.
Right. Again, it's sort of, interdisciplinary again, isn't it? Like bringing sort of the cinema arts and music together, and you're bringing different audiences too. And people might, you know, pull and appreciate different aspects of it.
Ching-Chu Hu, once again, you are a professor of composition at Denison University. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Jennifer.